Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Joshua Yunkin. Today, we're pleased to present the second of a three-part series taken from a recent talk given by Dr. James LaFanoux to a Seattle audience. Dr. LaFanoux is a critically acclaimed science writer, former medical practitioner, and author of The Rise and Fall of Modern Medicine, and 2009's Why Us? How Science Rediscovered the Mystery of Ourselves. In the previous segment, Dr. LaFanoux discussed how scientific practices are making increasingly narrow discoveries of limited applicability despite growing increase in material support. He suggests this might be due to a mismatch between the reductionist approach of genomics and neuroscience and the seemingly irreducible phenomena that these two practices would seek to understand. As Dr. LaFanoux explains, brain scans will never reveal what one is thinking about, and genes won't tell us why an ostrich is not an elephant.
And so we start with the first of those sets of technical developments, which were the ability to spell out this full sequence of genes of diverse species and explain what it is, which was predicated on the principle that to a greater or lesser extent, they would account for why it was that, for example, the flying dragon is different from the swordfish, is different from the two-banded armadillo. Or what indeed might explain the enormous profusion of faces or facial expressions of the bat world, which, as it were, seemed to exhaust the possibilities of design. This assumption was that to a greater or lesser extent, these genome studies should clarify this. But as we all know, as we do know, they actually have found the reverse. That across the whole range of organismic life, that we all share pretty much 20,000 genes. And this highlighted in this paper in 2001, which drew to attention the extraordinary phenomenon that we share, we humans, share the same number of genes as a millimeter-long nematode worm. And that was not the only problem, because just as perplexing was the question of why our set of genes were virtually interchangeable with those of mice and our primate cousins, and that there was nothing within those within the human gene to account for our characteristic upright stance and our turbo-sized brain. And even more concerning still, as Jonathan Wells points out in his Icons of Evolution, to discover that those regulatory genes are interchangeable between different species, so that, for example, here we have the distalis gene, which determines the shape of legs, which is completely interchangeable between the mouse, this worm, the butterfly, the sea urchin, and some centipede or other. So we are left in this extraordinary situation that for all that, this enormous amount of generated knowledge, this enormous, prodigious amounts of gigabytes of data generated by all these genome projects, we're left in the extraordinary situation that we now realize that there is nothing that we can detect in the genomes of fly and man which account for why the fly should have two wings, six legs, and a dot-sized brain, and we should have two arms, two legs, and a brain that can encompass the dimensions of the universe. Now, of course, the instructions must be there, of course, because otherwise forms of life would not pass themselves on from generation to generation with such fidelity. But fascinatingly, within the last 5 or 10 years, we have moved from a situation where we thought we knew what that explanation was in principle to realizing that we have no real understanding of the principle of genetic inheritance, with, I might say, devastating implications, which I don't need to go into here, for the prevailing evolutionary view of natural selection acting on the random mutation of genes as the determinant cause of the near-infinite diversity of life over the last 500 million years. Now, it might be futile to say, why should this be so? Why should it be that, as it were, we have this vast outpouring of information has proved so elusive and has failed to produce the answers that were predicted? And I don't really have an answer to that. But I think part of an explanation must lie is the fact that since Crick and Watson described the double helix back in 1953, we, or science generally, has been enthralled to the notion that the very simplicity and elegance of that DNA helix gives promise that we can understand the secret of life, if we could only decode what that message is. But it seems to me the point here is that the simplicity and elegance of the double helix is not because it is simple, but because it has to be simple if it is going to replicate the genetic mechanism of life every time the cell divides. And that obligation to be simple requires those strands of the double helix to condense within themselves in this one-dimensional sequence of genetic chemicals, the vast panoply of the three-dimensional richness of form and attributes of the living world. And how you get from that, as it were, one-dimensional sequence of chemicals to the living world seems to me to be beyond our current understanding and certainly beyond prevailing scientific theory. So that is genetics. And you will not be surprised to hear that it's actually been a similar story with the neurosciences. And because it was quite clear right from the beginning of these new sophisticated brain scanning techniques that the brain worked in quite different ways than really we understood or imagined. I wonder if I could just give you this quotation from Evelyn Fox Keller, which closes my last piece about the genome. Here she says that, as it were, the finding of all these genome studies brings us to one of those rare and wonderful moments when success teaches us humility. We lulled ourselves into believing that in discovering the basis for genetic information, we had found the secret of life. We were confident that if we could only decode the message, we would understand the program that makes an organism what it is. But now there is at least a tacit acknowledgement, or there should be, of how large that gap between genetic information and biological meaning really is. So that is Evelyn Fox Keller. So back to neuroscience, and you will be all familiar, of course, with the real estate of the brain and with the visual cortex at the back and sensory and motor cortex along the side, spatial awareness down here, hearing, taste, smell, and so on. And the opportunities of, as it were, investigating what actually happens when we talk about the world, these new sophisticated brain scans, provided enormous opportunities to investigate that further. And here is just one example of a study in which subjects were asked to, first of all, read the words chair, and that's the visual cortex, and then to listen to somebody say the word chair, and then to hear somebody say the word chair. And in each of these, as we see, it activates, you know, billions of neurons in each of the relevant sites of the brain. Ask that person to associate the word chair with the word sit, and the whole brain lights up. It makes you wonder, you know, what is going on in the brain when we have the most trivial and banal conversations, let alone trying to grapple with the sort of things I'm talking about this evening. And it's a similar thing with learning. Here we have somebody learning a set of 10 words, memorizing a set of 10 words. So there they are, that's that one. Huh? And, you know, it doesn't take very long to memorize them. And once they've practiced, their brain falls silent. And then they have to memorize another set of 10 words, and so it all activates again. So if this is what is going on, if you're just trying to memorize 10 words, what on earth is going on when one is trying to grapple with, you know, the profundities of computer science or, you know, whatever our computer friends here in Seattle are busy engaged with? And so too for perception and seeing the world. You know, there is this sort of common perception that somehow or other the visual world out there is impressed on the visual cortex as on a photographic plate. But the findings have revealed the reverse of the case, that that visual image is fragmented, like an exploding firework, into 30 or 40 different maps, with no real sense of how, as it were, it is all integrated together into a single, unified stream of consciousness, of stream of us seeing the world out there as an integrated whole. This is a famous experiment by a man called Semir Zeki, who's a professor of neuroscience at London University, in which he asked people, this very simple experiment, to first of all look at a colored picture and then at a series of moving images. And this is the color picture. It's a sort of Mondrian-type picture. And this one here is that these black and white specks were all sort of moving around one through the other. And this revealed that these two different things, the color activated one bit of the brain, these moving things activated another bit of the brain, and they both came through, as it were, the main part of the visual cortex at the back. And that's not just the end of it, because we don't just see color and movement. We also look to see where something is and where it's positioned. And that too reveals an extraordinary movement. If you're looking both for how you perceive an object and where it is, this involves all this extraordinary movement within the different parts of the brain. What all this adds up to is that when you work out what all these connections are in the brain involved in the simplest thing that we do, you know, every waking millisecond of our lives, looking out on the world, this is how it is fragmented by our brain. Here we have, as it were, a simplified version of this map, where it goes from the retina to the main part of the visual cortex, then up through all these others. But this is really how all the network works out. Now, commenting on this, the Nobel Prize winner, David Tubal, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on vision, made the following pertinent comment. This abiding tendency for attributes such as form, color, and movement, because it doesn't, of course, just apply to vision, but it applies to hearing and sense and smell and so on, to be handled by separate structures in the brain, immediately raises the question how all the information is finally assembled for perceiving a rounded, bouncing red ball. It obviously must be assembled, but where and how, we have no idea. And that no idea is no idea. And there are others. But essentially, beside all the other fascinating insights provided by neuroscience of the last 10 or 15 years, the fundamental problem remains that there's no understanding of how it is that one gets from the monotonous electrochemistry of the brain and the firing of all those billions of neurons to that unique sense that so readily distinguishes the smell of a rose from the listening to a Bach cantata, from the taste of whiskey. What is it? How does one get from one form of knowledge to another? And commenting on this, the philosopher Colin McGinn and makes this point, which I think is highly relevant. Suppose I know everything about your brain. I know its anatomy, its chemical ingredients, the pattern of electrical activity, position of an atom. Do I therefore know everything about your mind? It certainly seems not. On the contrary, I know nothing about your mind. So knowledge of your brain does not give me knowledge of your mind. And so, as it were, to summarize very briefly what is obviously a very complex subject, we are left here in the interesting situation of being confronted after 15 or 20 years of neuroscience with what the neurobiologist Robert Doty calls the five cardinal mysteries of the mind. And they are the mystery of subjective awareness, which is what I was talking about, and how it is that we see and perceive the world outside, the mystery of free will, how our non-material thoughts influence our brain to do one thing as opposed to another, the mystery and richness of the accessibility of memory, and one could talk about this forever. There's short-term memory, long-term memory. There's memory for received facts. There's a memory for our autobiographical memory. How is it retained? Where is it in the brain? The mystery of human and reason and imagination, of course, and the mystery of the self, how it is that we know ourselves to be and we know other people to be, this specific character and personality, which may change and mature over time, but essentially remains resolutely the same. Those, then, are the five cardinal mysteries of the mind. Now, of course, when these questions are raised about the perplexities, and they are indeed perplexities posed by these recent findings of genomics and neuroscience, the standard response is to be that, well, things have turned out to be a bit more complex than we thought. But with goodwill and sufficient and more funding, all will finally be resolved.
As Dr. Lafanu just explained, human consciousness and the architectures of bodily form don't break down neatly into discrete parts, as the scientific community would have it. These phenomena seem irreducible because they are, though reductionist efforts will and arguably should persist. In the next segment, part 3, Dr. Lafanu wraps up his talk and tells us what it all means. This has been ID the Future, and I'm Joshua Youngkin. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.